The Healer, The Healing Work of Mary Baker Eddy, compiled and arranged by David Keeston. Appendix 1, Second Continuation. An Arctic Aurora, from Tent Life in Siberia by George Kennan. On the 26th of February, 1866, there occurred one of the grandest displays of the Arctic Aurora which had been observed there for more than 50 years, and which exhibited such unusual and extraordinary brilliancy that even the natives were astonished. Late in the evening, there burst suddenly upon our startled eyes the grandest exhibition of vivid, dazzling light and color of which the mind can conceive. The whole universe seemed to be on fire. A broad arch of brilliant prismatic colors spanned the heavens from east to west like a gigantic rainbow, with a long fringe of crimson and yellow streamers stretching up from its convex edge to the very zenith. At short intervals of 1 or 2 seconds, wide luminous bands parallel with the arch rose suddenly out of the northern horizon and swept with a swift, steady majesty across the whole heavens, like long breakers of phosphorescent light rolling in from some limitless ocean of space. Every portion of the vast arch was momentarily wavering, trembling, and changing color, and the brilliant streamers which fringed its edge swept back and forth in great curves, like the fiery sword of the angel at the gate of Eden. In a moment, the vast auroral rainbow, with all its wavering streamers, began to move slowly up toward the zenith, and a second arch of equal brilliancy formed directly under it, shooting up another long, serried row of slender colored lances toward the North Star, like a battalion of the celestial host presenting arms to its commanding angel. Every instant the display increased in unearthly grandeur. The luminous bands revolved swiftly, like the spokes of a great wheel of light across the heavens. The streamers hurried back and forth with swift, tremulous motion from the ends of the arches to the center. And now and then a great wave of crimson would surge up from the north and fairly deluge the whole sky with color, tinging the white snowy earth far and wide with its rosy reflection. But as the words of the prophecy, "And the heavens shall be turned to blood," formed themselves upon my lips, and a lightning flash of vivid orange startled us with its wide, all-pervading glare, which extended even to the southern horizon, as if the whole volume of the atmosphere had suddenly taken fire. I even held my breath a moment as I listened for the tremendous crash of thunder, which it seemed to me must follow this sudden burst of vivid light. But in heaven and earth there was not a sound to break the calm silence of night, save the hastily muttered prayers of the frightened native at my side, as he crossed himself and kneeled down before the visible majesty of God. I could not imagine any possible addition which even the Almighty Power could make to the grandeur of the aurora as it now appeared. The rapid alternations of crimson, blue, green, and yellow in the sky were reflected so vividly from the white surface of the snow that the whole world seemed now steeped in blood, and then quivering in an atmosphere of pale, ghastly green, through which shone the unspeakable glories of mighty crimson and yellow arches. But the end was not yet. As we watched with upturned faces, the swift ebb and flow of these great celestial tides of colored light, the last seal of the glorious revelation was suddenly broken, and both arches were simultaneously shivered into 1,000 parallel perpendicular bars, every one of which displayed in regular order, from top to bottom, the 7 primary colors of the solar spectrum. From horizon to horizon, there now stretched 2 vast curving bridges of colored bars, across which we almost expected to see passing and repassing the bright inhabitants of another world. Amid cries of astonishment and exclamations of "God have mercy" from the startled natives, these innumerable bars began to move with a swift dancing motion back and forth along the whole extent of both arches, passing each other from side to side with such bewildering rapidity that the eye was lost in the attempt to follow them. The whole concave of heaven seemed transformed into one great revolving kaleidoscope of shattered rainbows. Never had I even dreamed of such an aurora as this, and I am not ashamed to confess that its magnificence at that moment overawed and frightened me. The whole sky, from zenith to horizon, was one molten, mantling sea of color and fire, crimson and purple, and scarlet and green, and colors for which there are no words in language and no ideas in the mind, things which can only be conceived while they are visible. The signs and portents in the heavens were grand enough to herald the destruction of a world, flashes of rich, quivering color, covering half the sky for an instant, and then vanishing like summer lightning. Brilliant green streamers shooting swiftly, but silently, up across the zenith, thousands of variegated bars sweeping past each other in 2 magnificent arches, and great luminous waves rolling in from the interplanetary spaces and breaking in long lines of radiant glory upon the shallow atmosphere of a darkened world. With the separation of the 2 arches into component bars, it reached its utmost magnificence, and from that time its supernatural beauty slowly but steadily faded. The first arch broke up, and soon after it the 2nd. The flashes of color appeared less and less frequently. The luminous bands ceased to revolve across the zenith, and in an hour nothing remained in the dark, starry heavens to remind us of the aurora, except a few faint Magellan clouds of luminous vapor. Meeting of my departed mother and husband. Joy for thee, happy friend, thy bark is past the dangerous sea, and safely moored at last beyond rough foam. Soft gales celestial in sweet music bore, spirit emancipate for this far shore, thee to thy home. you've traveled long and far from mortal joys, to soul's diviner sense that spurns such toys, brave wrestler lone. Now see thy ever self, life never fled, man is not mortal, never of the dead, the dark unknown. When hope soared high and joy was eagle-plumed, thy pinions drooped, the flesh was weak and doomed to pass away. But faith triumphant round thy death-couch shed, majestic forms and radiant glory sped the dawning day. Intensely grand and glorious life's sphere, beyond the shadow infinite appear life, love divine. Where mortal yearnings come not, sighs are stilled, and home and peace and hearts are found and filled, thine, ever thine. Bearest thou no tidings from our loved on earth, the toiler tireless for truth's new birth, all unbeguiled? Our joy is gathered from her parting sigh, this hour looks on her heart with pitying eye, what of my child? When, severed by death's dream, I woke to life, she deemed I died and could not know the strife at first to fill, that waking with a love that steady turns to God, a hope that ever upward yearns, bowed to His will. Years had passed o'er thy broken household band when angels beckoned me to this bright land with thee to meet. She that has wept o'er thee kissed my cold brow, rears the sad marble to our memory now in lone retreat. By the remembrance of her loyal life and parting prayer, I only know my wife, thy child shall come, where farewells cloud not o'er our ransomed rest, hither to reap with all the crowned and blessed of bliss the sum. When love's rapt sense the heartstrings gently sweep, with joy divinely fair the high and deep to call her home, she shall mount upward unto purer skies, we shall be waiting in what glad surprise our spirits own. During Mrs. Eddy's establishment of the Christian Science Church, there appeared across the civilized world in virtually every major newspaper, articles, editorials, or other commentaries on Christian Science, Science and Health, or Mrs. Eddy herself. One such was from The New Century, Boston, of February 1895. One point of view, the new woman. We all know her. She is simply the woman of the past with an added grace, a newer charm. Some of her dearest ones call her selfish because she thinks so much of herself she spends her whole time helping others. She represents the composite beauty, sweetness, and nobility of all those who scorn self for the sake of love and her handmaiden duty, of all those who seek the brightness of truth, not as the moth to be destroyed thereby, but as the lark who soars and sings to the great sun. She is of those who have so much to give, they want no time to take, and their name is Legion. She is as full of beautiful possibilities as a perfect harp, and she realizes that all the harmonies of the universe are in herself, while her own soul plays upon magic strings the unwritten anthems of love. She is the apostle of the true, the beautiful, the good, commissioned to complete all that the 12 have left undone. Hers is the mission of missions, the highest of all, to make the body not the prison, but the palace of the soul, with the brain for its great white throne. When she comes like the south wind into the cold haunts of sin and sorrow, her words are smiles, and her smiles are the sunlight which heals the stricken soul. Her hand is tender, but steel-tempered with holy resolve. And as one whom her love had glorified once said, she is soft and gentle, but you could no more turn her from her course than winter could stop the coming of spring. She has long learned with patience, and today she knows many things dear to the soul, far better than her teachers. In olden times, the Jews claimed to be the conservators of the world's morals. They treated woman as a chattel, and said that because she was created after man, she was created solely for man. Too many still are Jews who never called Abraham father, while the Jews themselves have long acknowledged woman as man's proper helpmeet. In those days, women had few lawful claims, and no one to urge them. True, there were Miriam and Esther, but they sang and sacrificed for their people, not for their sex. Today, there are 10,000 Esthers, and Miriams by the million, who sing best by singing most for their own sex. They are demanding the right to help make the laws, or at least to help enforce the laws, upon which depends the welfare of their husbands, their children, and themselves. Why should our selfish self longer remain deaf to their cry? The date is no longer B.C. Might no longer makes right, and in this fair land at least fear has ceased to kiss the iron heel of wrong. Why then should we continue to demand woman's love and woman's help while we recklessly promise, as lover and candidate, what we never fulfill as husband and office holder? In our secret heart, our better self is shamed and dishonored, and appeals from Philip drunk to Philip sober, but has not yet the moral strength and courage to prosecute the appeal. But the east is rosy, and the sunlight cannot long be delayed. Woman must not and will not be disheartened by 1,000 denials or 1,000,000 of broken pledges. With the assurance of faith, she prays. With the certainty of inspiration, she works. And with the patience of genius, she waits. At last, she is becoming as fair as the morn, as bright as the sun, and as terrible as an army with banners to those who march under the black flag of oppression and wield the ruthless sword of injustice. In olden times, it was the Amazons who conquered the Invincibles, and we must look now to their daughters to overcome our own allied armies of evil and to save us from ourselves. She must and will succeed, for as David sang, God shall help her, and that right early. When we try to praise her later works, it is as if we would pour incense upon the rose. It is the proudest boast of many of us that we are bound to her by bonds dearer than freedom, and that we live in the reflected royalty which shines from her brow. We rejoice with her that at last we begin to know what John on Patmos meant. And there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. She brought to warring men the Prince of Peace, and he, departing, left his scepter not in her hand, but in her soul. The time of times is near when the new woman shall subdue the whole earth with the weapons of peace. Then shall wrong be robbed of her bitterness and ingratitude of her sting. Revenge shall clasp hands with pity, and love shall dwell in the tents of hate, while side by side, equal partners in all that is worth living for, shall stand the new man with the new woman. Mrs. Eddy's Place, as published in the C.S. Sentinel, June 5, 1943. The position of the Mother Church as to Mary Baker Eddy's place in the fulfillment of Bible prophecy is clearly set forth in the following paragraphs. These conclusions are not new. They are confirmed by our leader's writings. And the steadily unfolding fruitage of Christian Science bears witness to their truth. 1. Mrs. Eddy, as the discoverer and founder of Christian Science, understood herself to be the one chosen of God to bring the promised Comforter to the world, and therefore the revelator of Christ's truth in this age. 2. Mrs. Eddy regarded portions of Revelation, that is, chapter 12, as pointing to her as the one who fulfilled prophecy by giving the full and final revelation of truth, her work thus being complementary to that of Christ Jesus. 3. As Christ Jesus exemplified the fatherhood of God, she, Mrs. Eddy, revealed God's motherhood. She represents in this age the spiritual idea of God, typified by the woman in the Apocalypse. See Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, page 565, lines 13 to 22. 4. Mrs. Eddy considered herself to be the God-appointed and God-anointed messenger to this age, the woman chosen by God to discover the science of Christian healing and to interpret it to mankind. She is so closely related to Christian Science that a true sense of her is essential to the understanding of Christian Science. In other words, the Revelator cannot be separated from the Revelation. 5. This recognition of her true status enabled her to withstand the opposition directed against her by the dragon, malicious animal magnetism. She was touchingly grateful to those who saw her as the woman of prophecy, and who therefore trusted, obeyed, and supported her in her mission. 6. This same recognition is equally vital to our movement, for demonstration is the result of vision. The collecting of this indisputable evidence of our leader's own view of herself and of her mission marks a great step forward. Wisely utilized, this evidence will stimulate and stabilize the growth of Christian Scientists today and in succeeding generations. It will establish unity in the field with regard to the vital question of our leader's relation to scriptural prophecy. As we record these important facts, we remind Christian Scientists of our leader's words, Miscellaneous Writings, page 308. The Scriptures and Christian Science reveal the way, and personal revelators will take their proper place in history, but will not be deified. The Christian Science Board of Directors.